This podcast is brought to you by Writers' Centre Norwich and the British Council, and was recorded at the first International Literature Showcase in Norwich, UNESCO City of Literature, in March 2015.
Hi everybody, I'm Geraldine Collins. I'm Director of Events and Exhibitions at the Royal Shakespeare Company. And we're here to talk about the shock of the new. We've all been giggling about wanting all the room to shock and to shock our audiences online. So welcome to people. I guess if you're online, you can swear at home and be shocking. So we wanted a moment of being shocking together. What we thought we'd do today is we'll all speak a little bit, so we've all kind of prepared something, and then we thought that what would be really great is to have a conversation as a room, because we're all really keen to hear what you think is the shock of the new, what your experience is of producing work that might be other or not mainstream, or even what you think of all of those words, because I find them quite confusing myself. So, as I say, I'm Geraldine, and I will talk for a little bit about my experience in that area. To my left is Shamila Bezum, who is... do you want to explain what you do? That might be easiest.
Yes. So I wear two hats. On one side, I'm deputy editor of Wasafiri, the magazine of international contemporary writing, which was founded in 1984 by Sushila Nasta, who's still its editor today. And then with my other hat on, I'm a partner in Speaking Volumes Live Literature Productions, which produces live events wherever we can, that we're very passionate about.
And then Matt?
I'm Matthew Clayton, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm Matthew Clayton, and I'm the literature producer for the Brighton Festival, and I'm the head of publishing at Unbound, which is a online crowdfunding publisher.
And Anna?
I'm Anna Selby, and I'm shockingly not an alcoholic. And I work at the South Bank Centre in London, organising international poetry festivals. And as a poet, I work with dancers and choreographers as well.
So, yeah, so we just thought we'd say a little bit from our perspective each. And then, yeah, as I say, would be great to have a conversation. So, as I said at the beginning, kind of from the title and the text itself, it feels like there's so much to talk about and to debate what we mean by shocking or what we mean by mainstream. In my career, I've both been in mainstream organisations, which I think most people would agree the Royal Shakespeare Company is fairly mainstream, but hopefully doing challenging things within that organisation, as well as being in more left field, less mainstream organisations. And I guess all of us do different work in different places, and we're influenced by the organisations that we're in, but we're obviously also our own people. So thinking a bit about Shakespeare to start off with, because that's where I am now, I think it's quite interesting that Shakespeare seemed pretty mainstream in his day. He worked with the Lord Chamberlain's men, he performed to court, he was a very wealthy individual by the time he died in Stratford 400 years or 399 years ago this year. He had a very large house and he'd done very well for himself. But as we know, he absolutely challenged all the time. And in his writing, there are so many challenges, and he enjoyed exploring the role of the other in his writing. So we've got a season this summer of Othello and Merchant of Venice, and we've been thinking a lot about the other and the outsider in those plays. He also was alive at a time when in Britain, we were busy exploring the world, you could say. And as Viola says in Twelfth Night, what country friends is this? And he, you know, in The Tempest, most famously, spends a lot of time thinking about the other and thinking about other new countries and new continents. At the RSC, we reimagine Shakespeare, so we don't just do Shakespeare, but we do those 36, 37, however many you define it as, plays a lot. So Hamlet, we've done about 90 Hamlets Which is kind of mind-boggling. So, you know, each time a director will come to that play and think about it afresh, and will think about the take that they want to have on that play and what they want to say through the play. I was talking to someone earlier about the recent production of Merchant of Venice that was set in Las Vegas. So, you know, everybody will bring a different take to the play, even if it's even if they want to be true to the text as far as possible. What I find really fascinating looking in the archives is you can see versions of the play that were really radical. So there's a director called Grenville Barker who did a production of Midsummer Night's Dream in 1911 that was, you know, really sparse, really bare stage, a really incredibly radical production of that play, kind of 50 years before Peter Brook did something similar. So it's quite interesting to think about when we're radical, and we always think radical is new, but is that so? And I'd be interested to know what you all think. So we worked with lots of new writers, did lots of Pinter, work with the brilliant Dennis Kelly, who wrote Matilda, as well as writing The Gods Weep, which was based on King Lear. And I think I'm probably the only person in the country that loved that play, because most of the critics gave it no stars. And I thought it was fantastic. So interesting as well to think about when things are accepted by the mainstream and when things aren't. My role at the RSC really is to bring new voices, new interpretations, new perspectives on the work that the Royal Shakespeare Company's been doing. So I think what I'm bringing isn't radical at all, but it is quite new to the Royal Shakespeare Company. So it's new to our audiences, it's new to a lot of the artists that are making work for the company, some of whom have been there for a really long time. And it hopefully helps people to kind of have a broader perspective about the work. So as we speak, we're installing a new exhibition by an artist called Susan Stockwell, who's responded to Merchant of Venice and Othello. And she's made kind of tiny flotilla of boats that's going to be in the gallery, that the sails are made out of currency from all around the world. And then in the what's called the void, so the big kind of foyer when you go in, going to hang loads and loads of sails, some of which are made out of packing materials and, yeah, again, things referencing the global nature of those two plays. A company called Stand and Stare, who are a kind of small digital company, made a really beautiful jukebox, which they've done in other places, and I got them to do a version for us, which talked about Hamlet, talked about Galileo. And what was really nice is it's really easily accessible tech. And I know you had a good conversation about digital yesterday. So thinking about ways that you can use digital to make things accessible and not for digital to feel like a barrier. And also I've brought some poets that I worked with in my previous organisation, Apples and Snakes, to the RSC. So when we reopened the refurbished Royal Shakespeare Theatre in 2010, Kate Tempest was one of the writers that we commissioned to do something there. Lem Cisse has been wandering around the British Museum in an exhibition that we co-collaborated. Malaika has been... Some of her poems are kind of in the walls of the building. So lots of different artists, hopefully kind of reflecting on and influencing what we're doing in the future. Stratford itself, who's been to Stratford-upon-Avon? Anyone? Oh, quite a few. So it's a beautiful place. It's very English. It seems very wealthy and affluent, and then with this kind of massive international arts institution by the river. But it's also been a place where there's been lots of radicalism over the years. Famously, in the kind of 1760s, there's a guy called Garrick who organised this huge parade through town with kind of Corsican rebels and fireworks and cannons and you know, kind of amazing, great big town celebration that the like of which we see now. So really ahead of his time. But of course it rained torrentially and most of it, all the fireworks went damp. But still every year we have a big parade thinking about Shakespeare. And yeah, he's interesting in that he didn't really like Shakespeare. He didn't really like the plays, but he liked what they stood for. So, you know, he was passionate about freedom and really, really believed in freedom. And I quite like the kind of the the naughtiness that actually you didn't really like the plays, you just liked the ideas. So hopefully I'm bringing lots of ideas and lots of fresh perspectives on Shakespeare in my work. Though I do like the plays as well, mainly. In thinking about the quote and the copy, I suppose I was thinking when I was preparing for this about that we can't be kind of either ourselves or other. So we talk about other from somewhere else. And I was reflecting about, you know, the RSC, we're both ourselves and other, and Shakespeare was himself and other all at the same time. And it seems to me that there's something really interesting in that and how we all embody both of those things. And yeah, I hope to hear something from all of you about how you think that works and how you embody both. So I'm going to hand on to Anna, who's going to talk a bit from her perspective in answer to the questions. Yeah.
So I kind of approached it as a kind of collective inquiry and really have thought about questions and things that we can explore with all the expertise in this room, with the writers and thinkers who are here from all over the world. So first of all, I thought about shocking things and even the word shock and the negative connotations that has of being disgusted by something or dismayed. But on the other side, the deliciousness of finding something completely unexpected or that challenges you and really makes you feel uncomfortable and question things. And I was thinking, you know, what in each society is it that people find shocking and who is it that is finding it shocking? And I was thinking kind of retrospectively, I like making lists. So I thought, what did we find shocking that now seems incredibly tame? And the list includes the waltz, Elvis Presley's hip movements, Grange Hill, which Sharmila gave me, you know, how, like, different pieces of literature that now we just think, what? How could we be shocked by that? And then from that, the consequences of people being shocked and when people are resistant to things and they try and block it or suppress it, and really acknowledging for writers the context that they are producing work from and under, I think is really key in terms of what we're talking about. And then I started thinking about the power of naming, and when you give something a name, you can talk about it. It's a real thing in the world. So I'm going to do a quick quiz with you. If I was to say that I went to see a piece of very melodramatic theatre, which had dramatic acting in it, singing, an orchestra, and none of it was in English, what would you think I'd seen? Opera, absolutely. But that art form, if we didn't have that word for it, it would be multidisciplinary or, you know, cross-disciplinary. And in my own work with dancers, at the Edinburgh Fringe, I was trying to persuade people to come and see a show. And it's contemporary dance, poetry, and digital art, which didn't seem very appealing to people as I was handing flowers out. But I realised there's no word for it yet, which is liberating because you have the freedom to experiment and there's more fluidity there. But there isn't something solid in the world that you can just say to someone, this is what this is. The next thing I considered is what we should find shocking or what in the future we will look back on and think, I am ashamed of myself that we didn't try and change that at that time. And within that, I was thinking, how do we support writers, reward them, encourage them? You know, it's through inviting them to festivals, through prizes in terms of financial support. And I've just got a list here of some of the major prizes in the UK. And you'll notice a theme that comes up. So the Bailey's Prize. I quote, "The prize is open to all full-length novels written in English by a woman of any nationality. The Forward Poetry Prize. Translations from other languages are not eligible. The Man Booker Prize. Following a change in the rules introduced in 2014, the prize is now open to novels by writers of any nationality published in the UK and originally written in English. T.S. Eliot Prize, again for poetry. Books which contain more than 20% translations or versions, imitations, or any poetry inspired by the work of one or more other writers will not be eligible. Percentages should be calculated on the total number of lines of poetry," which would have excluded T.S. Eliot's good friend Ezra Pound for being eligible for that kind of writing. And I think the subtext that we have to look at is, what is this saying? It's colonial, it's the empire, you know. And if you replace colonialization with occupation, are we saying you have to write in the language of your enemy, or your work will only be supported by us if you're not writing in your native tongue, or if you have enough money to get your language to a level where you can... It's hard enough writing in your first language, let alone writing in a different language. And I think also we can't honestly say these are the best books if you're not looking at the whole world's literature. It excludes writers like Elena Ferrante, Murakami, you know, these incredible writers, Francois Hertier, Hassan Blasim, you know, all these amazing writers. And maybe I'll finish there. I think we'll talk about more things in a little while.
That's great. Shamila?
Thank you. So when I was approached to do this panel, apart from first just saying, yeah, that's fine, and then not thinking about it at all, which is what I did do, I then started thinking about, on a personal level, what is the shock of the new to me? And two things emerged when I was, you know, thinking about it and writing notes. So first of all is my personal journey to work in publishing, which I'm sure, you know, everybody knows British publishing is still very white, very middle class, very Oxbridge dominated. So I was thinking about this and I thought, as a child, what did I grow up reading? What I grew up reading and loving, I'm not, you know, it's absolutely fine. I loved Enid Blyton. Mm-hmm. I loved, you know, Mallory Towers. Mm-hmm. I loved the classics, Jane Eyre or Laura Ingalls Wilder, all those kinds of books, and I didn't see any problem. And in fact, it wasn't until I went to Mauritius, where my dad is from, when I was 10 years old. And there, my sister and I discovered a load of comic books about Indian myths and legends. They were amazing. I mean, the pictures were amazing. The women were beautiful, I have to say. And, you know, we just learned all these stories about our cultural background that we didn't know, to the extent that when I got home, my sister and I used to ask my mum and dad, please let's go to Southall, which is in West London, the Indian part of West London, so we could go to one particular record shop and buy these comic books. And we ticked off the list. There was 200 comic books. So to me, that was the first shock of the new. And it was interesting. I had to go outside the UK to realise what was missing in my, you know, reading as a child. So that was one stage. And then the next stage, I have to say, probably came when I went to university. I went to Leeds University and a long time ago. And my mother, who is from Guyana, which is in the Caribbean, she had left school at 14 and come to England to train as a nurse. She said to me one day, would you mind trying to find these books for me? And I looked, and it was a list of books, and I'd never heard of these books, and I'd never heard of the writers. And I remember it still, David Dabedin, Cooley Odyssey, a poetry collection, a book called India in the Caribbean. And I was just like, wow, these are writers from the place that you grew up, and they're writing stuff that, you know, is about your, you know, background and the history of, you know, the diaspora, basically. And I was really shocked that I didn't know that that stuff existed. I was doing an English and history degree, and our English syllabus was, as you can imagine. So I think the nearest we got to doing anything that was kind of different was Joseph Conrad. So let's, you know, put it in some context. So to me, those two moments were key moments in telling me that actually there's a whole world out there, and I'm part of that whole world actually, and I didn't even realise. And I've been very lucky since, because through the Arts Council's traineeship to get Black and Asian people into publishing, which then stopped and then started and then stopped, and the same problems are carrying on with getting Black and Asian people into publishing. But I was lucky enough to work for both Virago and Heinemann's African and Caribbean Writers series, which introduced me to a whole load of voices that I just didn't know existed. So that's all the kind of shock of the new. Very quickly, two things have introduced me to the shock of the old. And one of those was discovering New Beacon Books. New Beacon Books is the UK's first black publisher and bookshops, founded in 1966 by John LaRose and Sarah White. When I was working at Heinemann, they approached me to take part in the Black Radical Book Fairs that they ran from 1982 to 95, which has paved the way. If you see writers of colour in this country at festivals now, it's because they did all that work then. And go and find out more about them. They're amazing publishers. John LaRose said he ran a publishing maisonette, not a publishing house, because they were so tiny. They taught me that there was writing from the Caribbean, from Africa, from Asia, that had been going on ever since, and they were publishing some of the early books by people like Alfred Mendez from Trinidad, writers I'd never really heard of. And then subsequently I went to work there and I learned so much about the history of what came, and the fact that I was shocked by this history was amazing. Very, very quickly, because I know I've spoken for too long. But the second thing about the shock of the old is a project I'm working on currently. And with Speaking Volumes, we are currently putting together a tour of ranting poetry. Now, I didn't really know anything about ranting poetry until I met a gentleman who is a ranting poet from the 70s and 80s. And learned that there's this radical history of, protesting working class poetry that goes back centuries. And in the 70s and 80s, there was a whole group of working class protesting, not protest because that's a bit hippie-ish, but protesting poets who were protesting about the politics of the day, against Thatcher, against the social injustice. They were allied to punk, to reggae, multicultural, fighting for racial equality and social justice. And a lot of their story has become forgotten, as with a lot of working class history in this country. Now, Tim's amassing an archive, Tim Wells, and he said, can we do something with this? So we started learning about it. And guess what? We've got a London tour with some old ranters and some new ranters. And we're hopefully going to, bring that out to a full UK tour next year. But the thing that all of that has taught me is that there's far more that I don't know than that I do know. And the most important thing is to talk to other people, listen to other people, and, enjoy that shock of the new and the old from wherever it comes.
Thank you.
Take that. Hi, everyone. I'm going to talk about something quite different to what you two have been talking about, you three have been talking about, and it's something very practical and probably quite boring, but kind of important, and hopefully I'll make the journey to making this point kind of interesting. And it's about how the structure of publishing in the UK leads to conservative publishing. And I hope that the message I give there is a universal message. I'm going to use some examples from the UK, but I think the point that I make is really it's kind of obvious, but it's really universal, but really important as well. So one of the things I do is I organise events at the Brighton Festival. We put on about 25 events. I've been doing it for a couple of years. So I've done 50 events for 150 authors, probably to a combined audience of 10,000 people. Not once in that time has a publisher approached me and said, can we get the names and addresses of the people that have come to the events and say, that like our authors? They've never, ever said that to me, which is ridiculous, daft, stupid, but really also very revealing. It reveals the way that publishers are not really interested in readers. They're not really interested in readers. And what that does, the effect that that has, is it means that it makes authors' jobs far harder, because with every new book that they publish, they have to go out again and try and find their audience. What that also means in turn is that the publisher's job is harder, because every new book that they publish, they're also in this predicament of trying to go out and find these readers again. What this in turn leads to is it leads to incredible conservative publishing, because what it means is that anyone that has a big existing audience that's found their own audience already is far more attractive to publishers. So that's why publishing is currently dominated by TV chefs, by pop stars, by celebrities, now by people that have big followings on Twitter and big followings on YouTube. So you could kind of say this is the same as it ever was. But this sort of pressure to from publishers not to go out and build audiences for authors, to rely on people that already have big networks, is sort of it's the kind of other real factor that's influenced this and has made it far harder for new, creative, radical voices to appear, particularly in the UK, has been the decline in bookshops in the UK. So in 2005, there were 4,000 bookshops in the UK. Today, there are less than 2,000. So the opportunities for publishers to put books in front of people has completely and utterly shriveled up, which means that, again, they have to rely far more on people that have existing audiences. So my message is, in order to encourage radical, new, innovative publishing, we should be encouraging authors and organisations to invest far, far more time in building their own audiences, building their own connections with people. So since we've been here, I've followed a few people on Twitter that have been tweeting about the conference. I've done it in a very ad hoc way. I haven't gone out there and done it kind of thoroughly. But if you add up, I did this at lunchtime, I added up the people I followed and I added up their network. And their network of just a few people in this room is 30,000 people. That's the size of a large town. It's incredible, and it's an extraordinary thing. So we've got this amazing opportunity for us as individuals that technology has given us to develop our own audiences and develop them for free. Now, these digital numbers, they don't actually mean anything unless you've got an emotional connection to that person as well. So there are people in the room that I've followed on Twitter and that have followed me back, but I haven't spoken to them. And those people that I haven't spoken to are not going to become my advocates. It's only the people here that I've spoken to and that I've built an emotional connection to that then will support me going forward. And I think that's really, really, really vitally important. So we've got this thing where technology has provided us with this opportunity to build these connections. There's also kind of another positive thing that's happening that means that we can kind of fight back against this conservatism, which is that actually, whilst some bookshops are closing, lots are opening. So in 2011, 87 bookshops closed, but 57 opened. Now, the reason why that is important, and it's really important, it's important because they're independent bookshops. And this is a really, really practical point here. Say I wanted to write an experimental novel about floorboards. If the book-selling community was simply Amazon, Watsons and WH Smiths, Watsons and WH Smiths are two big chains in this country. They're the only two big bookshop chains left. I would have three people to go and talk to and tell them that I thought an experimental book about floorboards had an audience and that there were people out there who had an emotional connection to it and would buy that book. 57 new people, 57 new bookshops. I've now got an opportunity to speak to 60 people. Within that 60 people, there will be someone there who'll go, holy shit, you're writing the book I've always wanted to read.
I don't think so.
Well, you know what I mean. And that's really, really important and really vital. That the ecosystem, that the publishing ecosystem is as varied as possible, because I think everything in life is about trying to find like-minded people and trying to find routes to those like-minded people. And there are various gatekeepers in the way that you either need to kind of kick out or you need to befriend or you need to get more of them that are more like you. So I'm going to give you a very practical example of something recently where all it is about capturing people's names and addresses. Capture people's names and addresses, build audiences. So for Unbound, we did a book 2 years ago with Jonathan Meads. Jonathan Meads is an architectural commentator. He does kind of TV shows, but he's a kind of polymath. And we published a book by him, and it took us 8 months to fund it. So we describe ourselves as a kind of crowdfunding publisher, but actually, really, the most exciting thing that we do is capture people's names and addresses that we can go back to again. So with Jonathan Meads, we published a book with him. It took us 8 months to fund. We went to him and said, Jonathan, what do you want to do next? And he said, I don't want to do a book. I want to do a collection of my photographs. I've been taking photographs on this phone that's 15 years old. They're blurred. They're kind of out there, out of focus, and they're a bit wonky, but I love them, and I think they're saying something about my view of the world, and I'd really like to share them with people. Now, no publisher would ever have, you know, everyone would have, like, they'd have indulged him, they'd have paid the bill for lunch, and they'd have said, oh, great idea, Jonathan. And they'd be like, no way do I ever want to touch his crazy idea about postcards. But because we had the names and addresses of, names and emails of 800 people that absolutely loved Jonathan Meads, we went there and said, Jonathan's got this wonderful idea. He wants to do a box of these pictures. And we funded that in 8 days. So there's just amazing opportunity, I think there is, that technology has given us for individuals and organisations to build their own audiences and through that do more interesting, radical, creative things.
Thank you all. So what we were originally going to do is kind of now spend 20 minutes talking to each other with you listening, and what we thought...
I haven't got anything else to say.
That's good. That's it. Your work is done. But what we thought might be more interesting, given that we're in this room of brilliant people, is to kind of ask you to contribute a bit earlier than maybe you were anticipating contributing, but to open up the conversation so we can have one conversation together rather than us having a conversation and you guys listening. So one of the questions that I'd like to ask you all is, and you, so yeah, we're one room, is kind of what, so we've all given our personal responses to what the shock of the new is, but I'd love to know, what did you think of when you read that title? What do you see as shocking and new? Who wants to venture their perspective? Now you're going to be quiet.
I don't find anything shocking these days.
Do you not find anything
they
shocking?
They don't.
No. Martin.
I think what's shocking is the sort of banality of a lot of what's output to people and the popularity of what's banal.
I'm going to try not to repeat myself because I gave quite a lot of opinions about modernism yesterday. I think what I thought, it's a way of moving over work that's about something quite philosophically basic about the way we see the world into a niche place. And it does that for a reason. Without making massive generalizations, to say it quickly, I think that when people are confronted with ideas and notions and experiences of the world that they feel frightened by, intimidated by, things that are massive like mortality, they either have the instinct to control it or to mirror it. So if something's complex and frightening, they either want to create a piece of work that is equally complex and frightening, or they want to do something that gives people comfort, even if comfort can't be had. There's nothing wrong with giving people comfort, but when you don't, it does shock people who want that comfort. And I think all that work that tries to mirror the complexity of life and the fear of those things is called experimental, avant-garde, modernist, and has moved over to the niche by using those words when, in fact, it's more about how you look at the whole world.
Mm. And I think what was interesting, and when we were talking, that actually a lot of the things that we were talking about are quite mainstream and, you know, not avant-garde or experimental. That actually wasn't what we were talking about. We weren't talking about things in different forms. And I thought Anna's point about things that kind of were seen as shocking that now are totally mainstream was really interesting.
Could I ask whether people think that literature has the capacity to shock at all now? The shock of the new, I think, comes from Robert Hughes. Yeah. The art critic Robert Hughes did a series about modern art, and he was taking it from Impressionism through the 20th century. And genuinely, the sort of response to the Impressionists, the response to Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon, later sort of art things, people seemed genuinely shocked. There have been times in the 20th century where certain poems have deeply shocked people. But do you think now we have lost the capacity to shock? Has anybody here recently been shocked by anything in literature in the sense of being caught up short, maybe felt very negative about, felt maybe it shouldn't have been done in some way, in the way that people clearly were shocked in centuries past?
Can I give a couple of examples? I mean, apart from the fact that I'm often shocked by the terribly bad submissions I receive at Wasafiri, but when Linton Kwesi Johnson was published in Penguin's Modern Classics, he was only the second living poet to be included in that collection, and he was on the front page of the Telegraph. And there was this kind of implied, not quite said, you know, British politeness going on, but really, what is this Jamaican poet doing who writes in this patois and has, you know, maybe glorified rioting or, you know, black people being angry about, you know, their position in Britain? And there was that implied notion that they were shocked that he should even be in that particular collection. And he, you know, his editor at Penguin was on Radio 4, again having to defend the position. So there was still, it seemed to me, this kind of section of society that was shocked that something could be entered into the so-called canon that wasn't the, you know, the usual fare. So I think that, you know, from my perspective, there is still a long way to go at breaking that in certain sections. And I still feel that there's a certain kind of trendiness that happens with different writers from different countries of different ethnicities within publishing that's seen as shockingly delightful of the other. And then we move on to the next trendy thing. Mm. So it might be, you know, pretty Chinese women writers one year and then Icelandic, you know, granddads the next year or whatever, but we don't quite take it as, you know, we enjoy the kind of shock factor of that exoticness, but we don't do it justice.
Mm. Mike.
I agree with Cortina in terms of what is shocking nowadays. And it takes me back to two things. First, the degrading of the mainstream taste for literature. Mm-hmm. And you see a book like 50 Shades of Grey is widely distributed. And this is a dangerous indicator for what is the taste has become, or what is a degraded taste. And also the role of intellectuals in our society. We don't have any Shakespeare or any Christopher Marlowe or any new Samuel Beckett who may create a different direction for people to follow. Today, our intellectuals are following and degrading, collapsing to fulfill people's taste. There is no work for upgrading people's taste and presenting new valuable literature for people to turn on a light at the end of tunnel. Today, I feel it's a global phenomenon. It's not something has to do with the English literature or Arabic literature. It's something has to do with a global phenomenon where it is easy now for people, and you see these massive number of writers and poets who would write you anything. It's like, you know, this coin telephone. You put that coin and you get to get a line to speak to. So I think it's what we have to work is trying to change the mindset of intellectuals themselves, because those who are producing literature should know the history a little bit, or have in-depth look for the history where Christopher Marlowe or Samuel Beckett or Molière and these people who were about to be burned by the church at that time because they were misleading the society in from the church point of view, but from other side in terms of literature, they were trying to provide or pave a new way for the public to follow.
Do you think that writing isn't happening, or that it isn't being seen? I was thinking about what Matt was saying, and kind of new ways of publishing or new ways that we can share writing. So is your experience that writing just isn't happening?
Right. You know, publishers, after all, they need to, you know, they are not funded. They have to follow the big names because the big names are selling, and big names sell because people's tastes are degraded. It's like, you know, chicken or egg, who's first? You know, work on the publishers and you know, make them to widen the scope of their selection, or just work on the intellectuals to provide us more decent literature. I think it's an ongoing circle, and you know, it has something to do with the mindset of people, how people should relate to societies, and how the intellectual role in the past was leading. Today, the intellectual role is following the public. You know, they try to just fulfill this passion and this craziness about being sold and read and making big numbers of sold copies.
Questions that I, sorry, I'll continue in it. One of the questions I wanted to ask in the old format was as well about what new forms that people have seen, or what new models there are that maybe we can think about how other voices can come through, or that might enable more. So yeah, I was interested to hear what Matt was saying, but just, I don't know, it might be interesting to pick that up in a minute, but sorry, go on.
Be interesting to know what people from the delegates in their countries, what they thought we should be reading that is new and innovative and exciting. I'd really love to be pointed out what I should be looking at that I will find challenging or interesting or innovative. That would
the
be really wonderful.
The greatest book club of all time.
Yeah.
Let's make it.
We could start it today.
You're right.
I think I have to remember that shock is certainly subjective, and what we may find shocking in the UK can certainly be maybe laissez-faire internationally. For example, when the first lesbian kiss was shown in British TV screens, that was shocking to quite a few newspapers, but there were plenty of people going, finally, it's happened. And I think the shock comes nowadays not in the message or in the art form, but how the art is delivered to us. There is nothing new and shocking about an erotic novel, but 50 Shades of Grey was shocking in how that was delivered to us, how it became a life force of its own, and how it just completely eschewed the normal publishing channels. And I think that seems to be where people are focusing on now, how we reach audiences through new and initiative ways, rather than what we're actually bringing to the audiences, first of all.
I think that the thing is also that we are moving into always in this dichotomy of center and periphery, you know, and probably what we should is truly find what intellectuals have been speaking about, mostly about this third place, move away from this, either this or that. It's not a two-way thing. Today, Alex mentioned a wonderful novel by Laurent Binet, 8888, in which the author questions all the time whether he can be telling you what he's telling you, and he questions himself. I think that's radical, what he's done in that novel, because he's doing what we are doing. Is okay, what we are doing is shocking, isn't it shocking? And probably the question is not that, but the questioning of whether it is shocking is the thing.
Yeah, it's like meta-shock.
Right, like it's probably our role at this time in the world is to question whether it needs to be shocking, mm-hmm. or to question whether we need to change anything, whether the medium or the channel or whatever it is. And I also believe that what Matthew said about the social networks is a way of moving away from, because then we become independent from this either center or periphery thing. We just move around it, outside of it. I've always thought that outside, things that happen outside are in general more, much more interesting than what is happening inside, because it's like probably too much of a constraint of a thing. But I think that's, and that's what's going on, for example, in Argentina at the moment. There's an impressive amount of very small publishing houses publishing what they think is good reading, and not caring about what the critics say or what the mainstream literature imposes on us, being us, you know, a third world country. We will receive translated work. We not choose what to translate.
And are those publishers, just thinking about the comments earlier, those publishers can survive economically? They don't feel that they need to publish 50 Shades of Grey or, so they found a way to balance that.
Thanks. I kind of feel like the title of this session is almost, it's kind of almost leading us into a cul-de-sac of discussion around new being somehow synonymous with being shocking. And I kind of almost feel like the surprise of the new might almost have opened up different conversations. Because like Matthew, I'm actually really interested to hear some of the kind of forms or some of the formats that you guys are working with and within that are new and that are pushing the art form. I mean, as an example, I work in spoken word, and I think Hannah Silver, who we saw this morning, is really pushing the boundaries of that art form, and it's new and exciting.
I thought that as well. I thought that was quite a shocking performance. Well, in a good way, and it was shocking because it was here at 9 a.m.
Yeah.
So in the context as well. And I thought that was really interesting.
But I kind of think maybe we could move. Well, I mean, maybe it's just me, but I kind of feel like I'd really like to hear about where people have found something that's new and surprising and amazing, and whether or not you've been personally shocked by it is something we could be discussing.
Yeah, no, that's good.
I was going to add to that, actually, because I found this morning quite shocking and in a good way, and I think there's two sides to that debate, really. In terms of what you were saying earlier, Anna, the kind of what is negatively shocking in a way, I think one of the most shocking things at the moment in the UK and in a country as affluent as the UK, generally, not just for literature, is this kind of increasing disrespect for art in general, and the kind of the case you have to make. And if you think of governmental cuts, generally that trend that art is almost, in this day and age, regarded as a luxury, as an add-on, as not a kind of ingrained part of every human being. That is, for me, in the negative way, the most shocking thing at the moment, and that goes through all art forms, really. On the other hand, the kind of the most positive side of what art can do and what literature can do in a shocking way is when I think things personally touch you and move you emotionally. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I thought this morning that piece, I mean, partly because of the timing of the day, but I think it was incredibly moving personally. And in that sense, I think anything and any art can shock you if it touches you emotionally. And whether that's in the art form itself or in the narrative that something relates to you and that you feel moved, almost to tears. I felt like that this morning. That's and I think that's duality between the kind of almost, that you think art is this, that you have to make the case that the government is thinking about it. Oh, yeah, well, it's nice, but do we really need it? On the other hand, it's the absolute one thing that connects people, that can move people, and it's that duality that is both shocking and incredible. I don't know what else to say.
And the kind of liberating at the same time as being shocking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I like that idea of the positive shock in the red top. Yeah.
Hi. thank you. That's really lovely to hear. I think it's kind of a good point about the word shock maybe not helping people, but I do actually want to just talk about that word a bit, because I think it's a word that I had to face when I was starting to make my work, especially the kind of work I was writing some years ago. And I was in Dartington College Library, and I was discovering novels by Kathy Acker and reading them, and I was shocked in a delighted way that fiction could do this, could change direction so swiftly and could mean so much without it having these kind of coherent narratives. And I was also just reading all sorts of things, and may I take a risk and shock the room with a line that shocked me? Mm-hmm. Is that okay? Yeah. I was reading Annie Sprinkle, porn star and performance artist, and she had a line in this book that said, fist fuck me up to the elbow and massage my heart from inside. And that line shocked me, and I thought it was beautiful. and I think it made me look at language in a different way. And I think that's what shock can do. I think it can change our vision of the world, and it can make language into something that's not habitual, that's not just automatic. And I guess when I was working with 50 Shades, in a way I wanted to put some meaning back into that novel, because yes, that novel shocked me in the sense that the woman in the novel asks not to be hit and clearly doesn't want to be submissive. That bit was shocking, but also what was shocking was that it's read by so many people all over the world. And it is being questioned, of course, many loads and loads of people are questioning it. But all the meaning was stripped out of it, and I think that's something you can really see in the film as well, when all that film had to do was show the surface, show the faces, show the cars, and the everything that used to kind of be in fiction is taken out of that novel. And it's incredible how you can't get into the novel. If you try reading it, I'm quite good at reading bad fiction. I know I can read a lot of crime and all sorts of stuff, but I couldn't get into that story at all because there isn't anything there. It's just a surface thing for readers to plant their, their kind of fantasies into, perhaps. But I suppose what I wanted to do with that language is to look at it differently, is force it to mean something, put it together with something else. And I think that's why shock can be very exciting, because it can just shift our view of the world, of how we communicate with each other.
Great.
Could I just maybe open up the perspective a little bit as mm-hmm. well, because I think we're getting, as you say, kind of caught up in this kind of very, just focusing on this word shock. And, I think that there's all sorts of shocking. There's shocking that's, negative, and shocking in terms of learning something, discovering something that's wonderful and being kind of thinking, my God, why didn't I know about this before? But I also think that for me personally, and I know how we've all worked, that, we are all about sort of learning. And I think that you have to be sort of open in a way to be shocked by things good and bad, and to know that you don't know a lot of stuff, because otherwise you can't, I don't think personally, you can be a really, good programmer or a good editor or commission things or whatever, if you're not open to sort of being, faced with lots of experiences that you've never heard of, or voices that you've never heard of, or language. And sometimes I remember that I've been to hear things or listen to things that I don't know the language even, and I watch a performer, and the things that performance does to me without knowing the language, but you respond in all these other ways, and that's a really amazing kind of experience. So I think it would be great to kind of hear those kinds of things as well, and to share those, because,
Can you give us an example then of where you've seen something new coming from a surprising place or a different place? I think that would be good to hear from some people.
Yeah. I must say, when Anna worked on Poetry Parnassus, where there was a poet from every country who came to London as part of the Cultural Olympiad, and there were poets who performed in all sorts of languages. One of your poets that you brought was Agnes Agbauten, who is from Benin. And she read she lives in Barcelona now, so she writes in four languages. She writes in Gun, in Spanish, in Catalan, and in French. And her performance, she would read in Gun, which I don't think, maybe somebody has heard Gun in this room, but certainly none of the people we had in any audience had ever heard it before. And people were moved on such a level. And then, she read, she or someone else read in Spanish. So some people had some understanding. And then somebody read in English. We had people in tears at different stages who didn't know the language at all, but the tone and the somberness or the musicality, it was just incredible. And, the other thing as well I should say is that I find that sometimes people underestimate people in this country, because I did have somebody say to me once, why do events outside London? And I said, well, I hate to say this, but people read outside London. But we took Agnes to Swindon, and there was a guy who was in his 20s just crying as soon as she'd read her first poem before he understood anything. That, to me, was amazingly, shockingly, brilliantly wonderful. So I think we should kind of, hopefully try and open it as much.
Yeah. Have other people got examples of where they've seen new things coming, or where they've heard new things? Please.
I saw a piece of work a couple of months ago. Some people in here might have seen it, but it was new to me. It's called Love Letters Straight from Your Heart. So I don't know if anybody else has seen it, but the premise of it's very simple. And basically, people write in advance with a song that they dedicate to somebody in the bit of the story. And there's two actors who've got a few set pieces, but then they weave these songs into the performance. So I knew that was the premise. So you get there and it's set up a bit like a wedding. So you're all sitting at a round table and they start doing the dedications, and at first you're thinking, this is a bit cheesy, I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable. And then it sort of takes you over, and it's absolutely, it's just one of the most powerful things I've seen in a long time. And near the start they said, right, we want you to make eye contact with the person sitting opposite you who's a total stranger. You have to maintain eye contact with them for the entire length of this song. And then they play a song about how beautiful somebody is and oh, their eyes and oh, their mouth. And it's so uncomfortable. And you're totally out of your comfort zone and you're shifting about. And then as the song goes on, something really magical happens in the room as everybody just sort of lets that embarrassment fall away and just sort of concentrates on the person opposite them as a human being. And just being unashamedly sentimental or unashamedly honest about feeling like that, it's just really rare and lovely. But the thing I just want to quickly share that sort of, it didn't shock us, it surprised us in a really nice way, was I went to a performance which was a dementia-friendly performance, and some of the people in the room had worked with the theatre company ahead of time, and there was an old lady there who had dementia, and she had sent in a suggestion for the cook in the place where she lived. And so they read out the story about the cook and what the cook meant to this lady, and then they played the song, and it was lovely. And then the old lady started singing the song, and she continued singing after the extract had finished. And the theatre company were brilliant because they just let her continue, and the whole room was sort of wrapped in this moment of just magic. Do you know what I mean? And I think that, to me, because I see a lot of work which is really good writing, a lot of work which is really intelligent, but to sort of feel like that is quite rare. So that was just a lovely piece of work which I saw quite recently.
Lovely. Behind you.
Yeah, I would like to give a double answer about the negative shocks and the positive, because I was thinking about what Samir said before about writing and the way writing has been now modeled by the publishers, and how authors are trying to become what the publishers expect of them to be. I mean, I'm generalizing here, of course, but there's a lot of writers in my country, in Mexico, that are now, and that was really shocking to me, that are now traveling to the States to take all these MAs in creative writing in English, and they're writing in English because they are thinking that they might just make the jump directly into English and stop writing in Spanish and start writing in English, and that will abbreviate the road to getting published in English, which is what everybody wants to have from the Spanish countries, Latin American countries, to be recognized in the English-speaking world. And so it was quite amazing, because that wasn't the road before. Not very long ago, people were writing in their own languages and waiting for things to happen, translations and so on. And that was really discouraging, because it really that's something wrong in the road. That's something that you're doing that is, and also I've been meeting with all these people. I'm always surrounded by writers, and they are always talking about how they are thinking of their novels in ways that are, they don't recognize it as that, but in ways that they are kind of close to what it's being trendy. So we had this thing about people writing about the drug trafficking, and that became very popular, and we had many really good writers writing about that. It became a huge trend in my country, so it was almost unescapable. I mean, you couldn't have those books all over the place all the time. Mm-hmm. And as it became a stronger trend, people start writing more and more about that. So that's really discouraging. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think there's a lot of writers that give you back your faith on literature, and I've been discovering many of them from all different countries. And it's a pity that countries like the USA or here in England, in the UK, translations are not as common as they should be. Yeah. I mean, I was shocked by the fact that American people doesn't really like to read in translation, in general. Mm-hmm. So there are not as many publishing houses that are translating. There's no tradition of reading in translation. Mm-hmm. So I think they are just looking at their navels if they are doing that. So But anyways, there are many writers out there that are doing great things. I'm just thinking about Pierre Michon, for example, or David Foster Wallace, or people that are really, really, really connected with what they feel they should be doing, and not what the market or the publishers are telling to do or suggesting them to do. So I just wanted to say that.
Thank you. I'll go there and then there. Yeah.
Yeah, so, working?
Yeah.
Okay. So what shocks me pleasantly so every single time is truck art in Pakistan. Every single time that I look at trucks which are painted so beautifully, and I think of the artists who have not got any training and the writers who are not educated, and they're just hilarious, sad, witty, satirical, and just so funny, those verses. And every single time I see a truck, I see new patterns and something new. So, for example, I could fall in love, except that I don't earn enough.
Thank you.
So I'm not educated in when it comes to literary stuff. What I went to school for is psychology and political science, which is totally separate from literary world. But I love poetry, and I've been writing poetry majority of my life. And speaking about publishers, if you're not educated, it's very difficult to find a publisher. But I found nowadays with technology, you can put your stuff up online and somebody will find you. For instance, I put up a poem online and then I got published in a textbook in schools. And they're teaching my poem, which I never expected. It's shocking to me that somebody would actually pick up my poem online, ask for my permission, and then want to pay for my poetry. And then I realized that now with technology, you can empower to become your own publisher. You no longer need to seek out a publisher. Mm-hmm. I had a good friend of mine who published a book, who's an engineer, published a book, self-published, and then was extremely successful, got an Emerging Artist Award because now they're starting to recognize self-publishing. And then she got somebody from South Africa, a publisher from South Africa, to publish her second book. So that was shocking to me, that it's actually changing in a good way.
Yeah, that's great. And great to hear.
I think also thinking about shocks and having just got back, I was at Karachi Literary Festival a couple of weeks ago, and yes, the truck art is amazing. I was on one of the things that I was getting from people in the audience a lot was sort of in what way is the novel relevant to us? You know, somebody said to me, what are novels saying about what's going on in Balochistan at the moment? What are novels doing? And I didn't know that I had an answer for that. And then I did an event with a writer called Benjamin, who is from Kerala and who wrote in Malayalam, I think is the language. And it's, firstly, it was the most astonishing novel. It's about a man who falls in love with a goat in the desert in Saudi Arabia. And it's about the loneliness. It's just an amazing book. And it's about the loneliness of that experience and the beauty of a goat.
I hope someone's capturing all these brilliant new things, because we all need to share them.
I now hold that out as an answer to that kind of question. Mm-hmm. What can a novel tell us in a world where, you know, as I was leaving Karachi, I was on a plane via Abu Dhabi, and I was on it with a bunch of people who were going out there for 4 or 5 years to work, in inhuman conditions for minimal pay. I felt like I was kind of, you know, this hideous sort of tourism of this tragedy. But I had this book, and this book took me into that situation in a way that absolutely shocked me, but also gave me hope, because you feel that if one person can come back from something like that with a story, that, you know, that we as writers have a place in the world, and we have a way of holding something against the really shocking, which is how fucked up everything is.
What do people think needs to change? What will help more of some of these brilliant stories? Can you see change on the horizon? Can you see more opportunities for self-publishing, for the sort of businesses that Matt's talking about? Or, you know, do you see change coming, or can you see what might need to change?
Hello. I feel quite positive about future stuff, future literature, because of working with a lot of younger writers and sort of noticing that when people are first sort of being encouraged to write or present their work, whether it be through poetry, mm-hmm. spoken word, or on the page, or theatre, whatever it is. That's where I come across my favourite new stuff, because it's completely individual to the people that you're working with, and it's coming out of them. And so what needs to change? I think a lot of things need to change, but I think one word that's been talked about a lot, just chatting, is sort of making arts and arts organisations relatable to those younger people coming mm-hmm. through. And we've had a conversation like yesterday about diversity and relatability and how those two things sit next to each mm-hmm. other. And we talk about diversity a lot, but maybe what we're really talking about is relatability mm-hmm. yeah. of those organisations. And maybe if we used that word a lot more as well and mm-hmm. sort of grew what diversity meant mm-hmm. to be a bigger definition, that might help those newer voices keep growing and yes, coming through.
That's a great idea. Yeah, yeah, I like that.
Yeah. in terms of what needs to change, I suppose just talking about or thinking about the UK, I think the point of work in translation is a really key one.
Yeah.
And I would argue very strongly for a lot of additional support to be put into support for work in translation for the translators, and also in facilitating this kind of international dialogue to be able to find out about this work. I think this idea of sharing, you know, work that people have found inspiring from across the world is incredibly important. Because yeah. what shocks me in some way in the UK is how hermetically sealed it almost is mm-hmm. from the rest of the world. And there's this idea that the literature coming out of the UK is, you know, the top, so why do we need to engage with anything yeah. else? When obviously there's a huge amount being published and being engaged with around the world, which we here, or a lot of people here, unfortunately, are not getting access to. Yeah. So trying somehow to shift that some way. Obviously, the border regime in the UK is another question. That's something else that I find pretty interesting.
Sometimes we're even hermetically sealed from our own communities in the UK, of course.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So. Absolutely, we are. So should we all make a pact at the end of this session that we'll all tweet something new with the hashtag? Then we can all share. If you tweet, if you don't tweet, you could ask a friend to tweet your thing for you.
Thank you.
Sorry, go on.
What people were saying about translation, and it's something that we do a lot of work at English Pen. We have a Writers in Translation program. It's been going for 10 years, and we've helped over 100 books kind of be put out there in the world, but a lot of it is European centric, and it would be good to kind of hear other voices and kind of people to feed into that and go, I've heard this really amazing author from I don't know where, but you know, this needs to be heard. But there are, I just wanted to say, there are organizations who are championing literature and translation, and there are lots of really great organizations who work with translators to get them going and do lots of really great work. So let's not be too down on it.
English Pen do really exceptional work. Yeah, they do. Yeah,
it's good to get even more support. Yeah. and make me think that what happened when you don't want to shock anybody and just write what you want and what comes from you and not shocking anybody, is that new?
No, I think
it's not.
Sorry, just another point. In history, when art has been shocking, mm-hmm. it's normally because something that is not regarded by the powers that be is presented as art. The shock is normally, how can you possibly regard this as art? and that's applied to visual arts, it's applied to poetry, it's applied to forms of modernist writing. And it was quite interesting. There was a discussion yesterday about gaming, and you are seeing in the UK, you're seeing gaming now starting to be embraced as a genuine art as opposed to mere entertainment. And I'm just interested whether in some of people's artistic communities there are challenges around art that's being produced but is not being accepted, perhaps, as art, and therefore not receiving support or not receiving validation.
I'll always follow Cortina. You know, the idea of what can be done is, I think more of, you know, this exchange of residency, residency, conditional residency, I mean, you always have the literature coming or the translated fiction or poetry coming from Middle East and other countries. But the chance to send a writer, an English writer, mm-hmm. or English novelists, to go speak of Asia or Africa or, you know, Latin America and live there and work on there, like, you know, early 60s and mm-hmm. 50s, late 50s. People used to sometimes to travel on their own because they were looking for astonishing people, astonishing the audience, or bridging the society with other societies, speaking of values, promoting values, the mutual promotion of values, and having some people again to here, to some novelists or writers to stay here and see the society with their naked eyes and be more critical and just to analyze you from inside, and you send someone to analyze the society from inside and bring some information and culture to the society. You know, it's not what we are writing and has been translated to you. Mm. It's how you can write about the other and evolving the other, because in the meantime, I feel like with this massive globalization process going on, it's every nation is becoming like self-centered. Mm-hmm. And we don't really care anymore about others because we have our domestic challenges and our internal affairs where we have to tackle and speak about it. But again, it's another of internationality or publicity where mm-hmm. the novelist or the writer or the poet will gain it, because today, I assure you, not only in Palestine, but also in the Middle East, the best intellectual will fail to name 5 English novelists mm-hmm. or 5 English poets. I'm sorry to disappoint you then in this, because yes, English literature, we do read English literature, but more, actually more into the classics. Mm-hmm. We go back to Shakespeare and Samuel Johnson and mm-hmm. all these old guys. But today, you have to be really, really good to be selected by a publisher in Arab mm-hmm. countries, because in Arab countries also, they don't do this translation for free because it's costly. And why should I translate a novel for a novelist, an English novelist who is just speaking selectively mm-hmm. about a yeah. very, very domestic issue? Even the issues of immigrants and other minorities in the society are not tackled. So I agree with Sharmila when she said it's quite being a white man thing going on.
Definitely. Thank you very much. I think you've got a brilliant idea there. So I talked to someone at the British Council. They might be able to help you. Okay, we've got room for like one more question, I think.
Let's try and be quick.
And the mic is in the hand of a white man.
I'm going to hand it over straight away. International colleague, someone needs to ask the mic.
Yeah.
Come on.
Do you want me to ask? Yeah, go. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if I'm going to ask or say something. I'm shocked by the fact that a lot of literature in my community is not written literature. So lots of stories on radio and performances, and no one talks about that. And of course, not in English, in other languages. And that's never considered. It's not in any discussion. Just shocked by that. And then I'm asking myself, so do these people also have conversations about that in the way we have conversations about literature that is written and published and text? It's just shocking to me how the many literatures that exist actually are not having conversations. Mm. That those that are doing oral literature are not talking with those that are doing this literature that is published. Mm. It's just shocking.
Mm. Thank you. I think that's a great point to end with. Thanks ever so much, mainly to you guys, for going with the spirit of the slightly revised plan. Thanks very much to Sharmila, to Matt and to Anna, but also thanks to you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the International Literature Showcase. Find out more about all of our showcase events and find new podcasts at internationalliteratureshowcase.org.uk.